ran to their little kitchen, the mirror of her own, and took a knife in either hand. Cynia had imagined how she would face death. She supposed everyone thought about it sometimes. In some scenarios, she was brave and stoic. In some, she was lost and fearful. Now, at the end of all things, she found herself just standing, like she was waiting for a train, waiting for Noel to come from the garden and join her. The door split open, and two Rakhund boiled through the shards. At the last moment, she charged toward them, her hands and fists. Something punched her just under her ribcage, and she lost her breath. Somewhere, very far away, Alston was screaming. The wide door of the near-field group's quarters stood in ruins. A smear of blood marked the side of it. The smell from inside was like a lab that had spent the day in sacrifice. Blood and fear. The body of a Rakhund lay in the corridor, its knife legs splayed like the petals of some terrible orchid. "Look," Ricker said, pointing at the ground. The same dots of red that the Rakhund had left walking away from Denia. Jessen put her hand on the remains of the swinging door and pulled it open. Alston sat where they'd kept their guard post. Blood had soaked his tunic and pants, turning the pale fabric a deep purple-red. His eyes were open, like he was still watching the door, still guarding, even now that all reason for the watch was gone. Cynia lay on the floor, face down. The pool of blood around her was small. She hadn't lived long enough to bleed out. Ricker, in the kitchen area, made a small, despairing sigh. Merrill and Lauren Morse lay side by side on the floor, both face down and motionless. Ricker didn't look angry or frightened. He looked old. He looked weary. "We have to check upstairs," Jessen said. For a moment, she thought he hadn't heard her. Then he nodded. The ladder leading to the bedrooms and the shower had streaks of blood on the rungs and bright new scratches in the metal. Jessen lifted herself up, trying to imagine how the Rakhund would have swarmed up the ladder. She dismissed the trembling in her hands and legs. She had work to do. Weakness could come later. She paused in front of Jellit's room, too aware that the next few seconds might divide her life into before and after. There was no lock. All she had to do was pull on the little handle. She didn't want to. Something touched her hand. Ricker. He wrapped his fingers around her palm. She took his hand. She had to do this. She was grateful she didn't have to do it alone. She took the little handle and pulled. The door swung open silently on papery hinges. It took her almost two long, unsteady breaths to understand that the body on the floor wasn't her brother. Else Yannin lay on her back, one arm folded across her belly. Her chest was still, her face pallid in death. Her copper-colored hair spread around her head was the only red in the room. There were no wounds, no blood. They knelt beside her corpse, still hand in hand.
"This isn't like the others," Ricker said.
"All right," Jessen said. The emptiness of her voice said the rest for her. It didn't matter. Something inexplicable had happened. Someone they knew and cared about, maybe even loved in their way, was dead. She didn't have the resources to care about the details. She squeezed Ricker's hand and let it go. There were more rooms to search, more opportunities for destruction, but all the other bedrooms were empty. Jellit wasn't there. It didn't mean he was alive. He could have been visiting one of the other work groups or off on some errand for Merrill or Austincourt. The Carricks could have slaughtered him someplace she didn't know to look. When they were done, the rooms all searched, they walked out to the corridor together. Ricker swung the shards of the wide door closed and leaned against the wall beside them. One of the tall, bone-carapaced aliens lumbered by. A phylarch. A group of things that looked like jeweled crabs. Four of the squat-bodied, long-limbed, soft Lotharch, moving together and making soft screeching noises at each other that were probably words, gathered around the body of the Rakhund, gesturing at one another and at it. "We should," Ricker began, and then seemed to lose his train of thought. He seemed distracted, or sick. In shock. Of course he did. "We'll go home," Jessen said. "They'll need to know about Sinia and Else. There might be news about the others." "Yes, I hope the others are all right. I can't believe that Denia, I mean, I can, but I don't know what I mean." He took a deep breath and blew it out. "It's all happening again. Just like on Agian. It's all happening again. Not again. Still. It's still happening. We just lost sight of it for a little while." "Yes. Yes, that's right," Ricker said. Then a moment later, "I think I'm going to scream now." He said it like a sick child announcing he was about to vomit, equal parts dread and apology. "Go ahead," Jessen said. "It's all right." Ricker blinked, nodded, then took another deep breath. The first howl was weak and tentative. The second deeper and more authentic. All the ones after that were raw and ripping. The kind of grief and horror that tore the throat and darkened the face with blood and loss. His jaw didn't close between them, just gaped. He leaked spit and tears and snot as he screamed and screamed and screamed. After a while, he sank to his knees, and Jessen sat beside him. The aliens walking past didn't pause or stare. Why would they? For all they knew, this was normal. Just something primates did. Chapter 34. The last of the fivefold captives of Ayaye system died reciting a series of concepts in a loop, and Akur of the cohort Taklal debated with itself whether the repetition was a symptom of mental collapse or a chosen death ritual, reflex or prayer. Either way, its five limbs spasmed, curled upward, shivered, and ended their biological activity. What had been the physical manifestation of a mind became an inanimate object. That was what death meant. The interrogator librarian settled into its niche, isolated from the animals, distilled its conclusions, and prepared to pass a report up to its superior. The things it had learned would inform the superior's report to the tier above it, and so on until it reached the regulator librarian and, through it, the sovereign herself. The organism claimed to be artificial, a half-mind built from living tissue. The truth of the claim is ambiguous, as evidence exists to both support and refute it. The summons came before it had a chance to finish its final composition. The chamber it was called to wasn't in the same part of the world palace, but it wasn't a long journey either. Ekur Taklal put away its tools, rose up on its legs, and went to the transport queue at the top of the great arch. It had no subordinates to inform of its actions, and the summons had come from above it in the order of things. The only ones that might be concerned with this unexpected meeting were the animals it passed along the way, and the interrogator librarian had no interest in them. The ship that waited for it was small but well-appointed. The pilot wasn't an animal, but a Carrix artificer, successful enough that it was still male. Ekur Taklal was prepared to be ignored, but the pilot was welcoming and deferential, despite its higher status. When they lifted off, they continued straight up into the higher atmosphere. The ship they landed in was the color of bone, wider than a level of the Great Arch, and buoyed up by thousands of gold and silver drones. The transport landed in a dock of polished stone, and the guards that waited to escort the interrogator librarian were as tall as soldiers, but gendered. These male guards were red and gold, the scents from their bodies acrid and floral, and full of threat. The strangeness of it all made the librarian's head swim. That or the cocktail of pheromones in the air. The dock was like well-turned ground and rain-slaked stone. It was rich and biologically active. Organs in Ekur's abdomen, long ago shriveled to vestigial nubs, filled with blood for the first time in decades. The escorts exchanged looks as they helped guide it down a wide, bright hallway, amused, the librarian thought, by the ways its steps weaved and stumbled. Its body was changing, an answer to chemical signals it didn't consciously understand, and the sensation was eerie and intoxicating. When the two guards ushered it into the meeting chamber, its legs gave out at the joints. It sank to the deck, overwhelmed. Its fighting arms spread against the cool stone, and it pressed its face to the floor. The sovereign sat, her vast legs tucked beneath an abdomen sheathed in filigree and pulsing with light. Her 100 eyes shifted with a glorious independence, and her feeding arms, each as thick as the librarian's fighting limbs, were tucked elegantly against her thorax. If she had commanded it to die, the librarian would have ceased to be without a second thought. At her side, the regulator librarian was less overwhelming only by comparison. Ekur Taklal felt the organs of its body softening, beginning to liquefy, preparing to remake itself in whatever form was required of it. Even without direction, the metamorphosis was underway. "We have news," the regulator librarian said. "The battle at Ayaya is ended. The dactyl you served is gone." "Yes," Ekur Taklal said. "Your place within the moieties has altered. Your duties and responsibilities will alter as well." "I submit." "There is a subject species that appears to be related biochemically to the pilot captives you brought. We have come to honor its keeper, librarian, and address an incident. Your service to the Carrix will involve these."
"It will," Ekur Taklal said, and its flesh shifted and lurched as its body hurried to accept the changes, becoming again what it was told to become. "I will. I will."
When the slaughter was over, and the keeper librarian of the human moiety returned, it had two soft Lothark escort Dafydd back to his rooms. He didn't know where they took Jellit. Someplace else. Walking home, he kept imagining the moment when he told Jessen that her brother was all right, picturing her relief. It was the only good thing in a world full of bleakness and guilt. He clung to it. Two Rakhund were shifting restlessly in the hallway outside their quarters. The wide door was rolled open. Jessen, Ricker, and Kampar were sitting by the window, as silent as people at a funeral. Tanner, in the kitchen, was taking plates and cups one by one and smashing them on the floor. Else and Cynia were missing. She's dead. Else is dead. Tanner had said it. They're all dead. It had been like a brick thrown at Daffod's forehead. The sense of impact first, and then a slow bloom of pain that overwhelmed everything. After that, even the news that they'd traded Jellit's life for Austencore's conspiracy seemed small. Now that the other deaths had come, they were all Daffod could think about. The Carricks came for them on the morning of the next day. The sun had come up long enough ago that the rose and gold had vanished from the high clouds. A glimmer of lights that Daffod thought of as ships or transports or some technology he hadn't yet imagined passed across the brightness of the sky. The wide door slid open, and two of the Carricks were in the hall, half a dozen Rakhund behind them. One of the Carricks was the librarian. The other Daffod hadn't seen before. It was a little larger. Its flesh was darker and more purple, and it had streaks of bright red along its massive forelegs.
"Come with us now," the new Carrick said.
Its voice box rendered it in lower tones than the librarian's, and with a flatness of effect that felt like a threat.
"All of us?" Kumpar asked. "All of you," the new Carrick said.
"Can you give me a moment to pack?" Kumpar said, his tone light and breezy, the way it got when he was angry or stressed. "I'm sure I have my overnight bag here somewhere." The new Carricks raised up a bit, one of its heavy fighting arms coming up off the floor. Kumpar immediately bowed and said,
"I will come with you." All the mocking humor gone from his voice.
The arm lowered. The five survivors of Tanner Fryce's celebrated work group lined up like schoolchildren under the eyes of a strict teacher. The Rakhund pulled the door closed behind them and then walked at their sides as they went. The hallway they took led up along wide metallic ramps. Daffod noticed the aliens around them shifting to make way or to join their formation. More Rakhund and Sinan and Soft Lothark, the war dogs of the Carricks. More of the Carricks themselves, and more of those with a carapace and larger build of soldiers. Fewer of the bound species that served in the wide cathedral and alcove laboratories. The Carricks turned at a huge archway, leading them out onto an open-air platform. The air smelled rich, like the end of a rainstorm, and the wind was cool against his cheek. The transport they were led to looked too thin and delicate to hold them all, but the Carricks and their guard didn't pause, so Daffod didn't either. When it rose, humming into the wide air, Jessen caught her breath. It was the first time they'd been outside a building since they'd arrived. The transport swung out wide around the massive structures. Huge bulwarks with tens of thousands of windows, like the one they'd lived behind, flashing in the light like sightless eyes. The ziggurats shifting with the parallax of flight, showing just how massive they really were. The planet below was so far down, it seemed impossible that there was atmosphere enough for them to breathe. The Carricks whistled and trilled to each other, but no translation came. Whatever they were saying, the little box around Daffod's neck didn't think it was meant for human ears. When it approached a different building, or maybe a different arm of the same vast world palace, Daffod had to fight the sense that they were being swallowed. The entrance they passed into was more vast than any cavern. The pillars that rose through it were larger and taller than the scholars' common back on Agion, and they seemed tiny and thin in the space. The transport's hum grew deeper, and it began to descend. The space below them was like an arena or a theater without quite being either one. A rough semicircle centered on a dais, and kneeling in rows like the pious on their pews, were more human beings than Daffod had seen in one place since the fall of the Irvian Research Complex. There had to be thousands of them, a sea of grim, terrified faces. At the center of the dais, with a dozen Carrick soldiers on either side, was the largest Carrick that Daffod had ever seen, twice the size, easily, of the bone-pale one they'd been presented to when they'd first arrived. It wore a mesh of silver and emerald, and its abdomen was encrusted with a complex of fine wire that seemed to pulse with a life of its own. Its massive forelegs were as thick around as the librarian's chest, and the thinner, mantis-like arms were folded together before it as if in prayer. Two only slightly less massive Carricks stood at its sides, in carapaces of crimson and gold, radiating a sense of menace and barely restrained violence. Guards, or executioners. The transport landed just before the dais, and the Rockhund guided the five of them out to a bare place on the floor where, from context, it seemed they were meant to sit. "Does anyone know what's going on?" Tanner asked. His voice was peevish. "We did what they wanted. We made the thing work. We saved them from Austencore, even when it meant losing our own people. You'd think that half a minute's orientation wouldn't be too much to ask." Ricker cleared his throat. "Tanner, this isn't the time for complaints to the management." Tanner bristled, but he sat. Daffod knelt down too, and the others followed. Across the way, also in the front row, Jellit was sitting, legs tucked under him. His face looked thin and pale, but his eyes were as wide and amazed as a child at his first circus. Daffod could tell from the relaxation in Jessen's shoulders the moment she saw him, and he felt a little relief too. Whatever he'd done, he'd kept Jellit alive, or else had, whatever she'd said to him, or shown him. With a little shock, he remembered again that Else was dead, and the memory was like a vast hollow opening just behind his breastbone. Another transport arrived, floating down from the wide air like a basket being lowered on invisible strings. Another dozen people spilled out and were taken to their places at the back of the grouping. The best of Asian, if Else's spy was to be believed, all humbled and humiliated together. A few were looking around the way he was, faces turning one way and another, searching for someone or something familiar. Many more stared straight ahead, their eyes emptied by all that they'd been through. At the dais, the huge Carrick stepped forward, and a procession of smaller animals or machines that Daffod hadn't seen before appeared, trundling out to surround the dais. They were the size of large dogs, but where the heads would have been, they opened up like gigantic lilies. When they'd taken their places, a roll of sound began, chirping and trilling and humming like deep bird song. The voices of 100 Carricks lifted together. The chorus reached some deep part of his brain that said predator and made him want to stay very still. When the chorus ended, the huge Carrick trilled and muttered, its forearms tapping together in a complex pattern that might or might not have meant anything. Its vast abdomen swayed like a boat on gentle waves. Tanner beside him leaned forward. "What are they saying?" "I don't know." "You didn't bring the thing, the translator?" Daffod pointed at it. The silence coming out of the box was self-explanatory. Tanner let out an exasperated sigh. Deep in his memory, Else said, "When he's overstressed, Tanner can get petty. It's his pathology."
"Given context, I assume this is about the resistance," Kumpar said. "Could be about our finishing the project the way they wanted," Tanner said. "I think you're all underestimating how important our work is."
Look at all the different species they have under one umbrella. If we can make it so they don't have to have a separate agricultural source for every one of them, we're made from gold.
Keep your voice down, Jessen said.
We stopped the conspiracy, too,
Tanner said, and Daffod winced.
They wouldn't have known a damn thing without us. We paid a lot, a fucking lot. Be nice to see that recognized.
On the dais, the Carracks with black and red arms stepped up in front of the larger one, tucked its legs under it, and lowered its head like it was praying. Daffod could hear its voice, what he assumed was its voice, but not coming from the dais. The flower-headed dogs were relaying the sound like speakers. He let his gaze wander, following the arc of soldier Carracks arrayed behind the huge one. An honor guard, maybe. As if this particular individual was too important for any mere alien to serve. One of the soldiers caught his attention, and for a moment he didn't know why. It was large, but no larger than the other soldiers. Its shell was a vivid green. It was larger than the librarian, than any of the librarians, and still dwarfed by the grand Carracks on the dais. Its head was odd, though. Like something had taken a bite out of it when it was young. And he understood. Between one moment and the next, it came into place like something he'd known before and was only remembering. The librarian of the hallway crows, with its three scars, and the soldier with the matching marks. The night drinker's librarian, with its broken leg, transformed now into a green soldier on the dais. The translator's hiccup when he'd upset the librarian. The difficulty that the system had suffered trying to change a single, unified Carracks idea into something a human could understand. Essential nature and place in society. An animal doesn't choose that. And neither did the Carracks. Carracks changed with their social status, their place in society literally determining the form of their bodies. The ones who were victorious were better suited. The ones that failed were inferior because they had failed. Possibility was an illusion. That was what the librarian had said. But what it meant was choice. What happened, happened. What didn't, didn't. A species was useful to the Carracks, or it was not. They ruled their universe because they did. The other species didn't because they didn't. For a moment, Daffod Alcor saw the universe the way a Carracks would, and it was beautifully simple and utterly horrific. The huge Carracks intoned something in reply loud enough that it wasn't repeated by the dogs. The new red-armed one shuddered in a way that Daffod thought of as a bow, and it started moving off to the side. The human's keeper-librarian marched forward, solemnly taking the place where the other one had been. Tanner made an impatient sound. Then he stood up. "Excuse me," Tanner said, raising his hand. Hey, excuse me. Could we have a translator here at least? We are part of this, you know.
Jessen's face went pale. Ricker and Kumpar exchanged a look of confusion and alarm.
Tanner took a few steps toward the curve of flower dogs, his arm still raised in what he didn't know or didn't remember was a gesture of challenge. An invitation to violence. The librarian and the huge Carracks both turned toward him. The librarian leaned back into the four legs of its abdomen, lifted its massive forelegs like it was getting ready to embrace the universe. Daffod didn't choose to move. If he'd thought about it at all, he wouldn't have. The time it took to think would have been longer than Tanner Fryce's life. He was already up and running, fully committed, by the time he knew he was going to. He barreled into the backs of Tanner's knees. Tanner yelped as he fell, but he hit the ground. The assembled mass of humans gasped and murmured as Daffod grabbed Tanner and rolled him onto his belly. "Put your arms out at your side," Daffod said as he took the position himself. "What are you talking about?" Tanner spat. "I'm not going to lie face down. Put your arms out. They are about to kill you. You are seconds away from being dead." Tanner scowled and lifted his head. The librarian had its forearms out at its sides. The crushing blow would have taken less than a heartbeat. "He is young," Daffod shouted into the ground, hoping that he would be heard and that there were translators somewhere that would pass the message on. "We are both young. He didn't know better. He meant no disrespect. He's young." Tanner looked back. The universal fear on the sea of faces seemed to snap him back to reality, and he let his head drop to the floor. A moment later, he pushed his arms out to the side. "I am young," he said, his voice hardly more than a breath. "I didn't mean anything. I'm young." The librarian didn't move, but the two massive red and gold Carricks surged forward. Daffod didn't think about it. As if by instinct, he stood, lifted his knee, and stomped down on Tanner's elbow with his full weight. The snap of bone and Tanner's pained shriek filled the air. The Carricks paused. "I take responsibility for his correction," Daffod said. "He is humbled." Daffod lay back down on the floor at Tanner's side and waited to see if it had been enough. For what felt like hours, but was a minute at most, they were still before their captors. The huge Carricks sang something, and the clicking of sharp, knife-like feet announced a Rakhund coming close. Daffod closed his eyes, waiting for the attack. But instead, something grabbed his ankle and hauled him backward, scraping along the floor. His tunic rode up to his armpits. The Rakhund released him back beside Jessen and Ricker. Another dropped Tanner beside them before returning to their place among the guard. Tanner sat up, his face pale except for a long, bright scratch along one cheek. On the dais, the librarian turned back to the huge Carricks. "I just wanted to make sure we got credit," Tanner said, weeping and cradling a rapidly swelling arm. "We did all the work. We should get..." Kampar put a wide, comforting hand on Tanner's shoulder. "Be quiet, love, or I'll snap the other one for you." Their librarian was chirping and trilling its deep bass. It planted its dark forelegs and leaned forward until the pale arms reached down to touch the floor, the back of its neck exposed to the one in silver and emerald. The soldiers shifted from side to side in excitement or anticipation. The flower dogs murmured a wild chorus of trills and chirps, the voices of a thousand Carricks who were there but not physically present. The large Carricks let out a deep, fluting moan, unlike anything Daffod had ever heard. Then the two guards stepped forward and placed their heavy fighting arms on the librarian's back. The huge Carricks in silver and emerald gently placed one of its massive arms on the librarian's head. The crack, when its head was crushed, reverberated like a gunshot across the dais. Afterward, they were taken back to their rooms. For a long while, no one spoke. Kampar sat on one of the sofas, leaning forward with his elbows on his knees. Ricker and Jessen constructed an ice pack and splint for Tanner's broken arm. Kampar broke the silence. "What just happened?" "Daffod broke my fucking arm," Tanner said. "He saved your fucking life," Jessen said. "What were you thinking?" "I wasn't," Tanner said, and then a moment later, and with an exhausted kind of sorrow, "I'm not really myself right now." Ricker lay down on the floor, and raised one arm in a gesture that was at the same time open and despairing. Daffod wondered if, in another time, they would have been as sapped by the violence. There were only so many horrors they could witness, only so much outrage and fear they could hold in their hearts, before they were just exhausted by it. The weight that bent Kampar's shoulders and pressed Ricker to the ground wasn't the execution of the librarian. Or not just that. It was Sinia and Else, Noel and Irina. It was the destruction of Agian and the Night Drinkers and the execution of the Near Field group. Even the moments of success were drowning in darkness. Daffod tried to imagine what Else would have said, where she would have sat, how she and the secret spy would have made sense of it all. He couldn't. Heavy footsteps sounded from the hallway. Ricker sat up. The Carrix that opened the door and came in was the same black and red one that had escorted the librarian to its death. The one that had spoken on the dais and survived. It moved with a calm grace. Its steps so smooth it seemed like it was gliding. It had one of the translators around its neck, but its muttering and churring weren't being passed on. Tonner walked toward it, then hesitated, and stepped back like he was trying to judge its reach. Kampar watched it like he was watching a lion in a menagerie, like there was some invisible cage that kept him safe from it. The new Carrix shifted its eyes from one to the other of them. Daffod couldn't tell if it was identifying each of them, or watching for signs of an attack, or lost entirely in its own thoughts. He'd only ever spoken to the librarian. He didn't know what gestures and habits were common to all the Carrix, and which had been idiosyncrasies of the one individual. He'd find out, though. Something moved behind the Carrix, a more familiar form, walking just behind it. Jellit limped into the room. Jessen let out a cry and ran to her brother. For a moment, they held each other. Daffod watched the embrace and tried to take comfort in it himself. Whatever else he'd done, he'd also done this. The Carrix planted its massive black and red forelegs, leaning its weight onto them. Its abdomen shifted gently from side to side on smaller, graceful, uneasy legs. It seemed to consider them all, and then turned to Daffod, focusing its attention on him as if by breaking Tonner's arm he'd identified himself as the leader in the Carrix's eyes. When it spoke, the voice box translated it with a different voice, not the genderless matter-of-fact of the soldiers or the reedy calm of the librarian, but something more fundamentally threatening. "I am Ekur of the Cohort Taklal, and I have been made the new keeper-librarian of the human moiety. Your place within the moiety has altered. Your duties and responsibilities will alter as well." It shifted its weight. It waited, as if it anticipated some response. None of them spoke. After a moment, its pale feeding arms unfolded, its clawed hands interleaving in something like prayer. "First," it said, "as your librarian, I congratulate you all on your success." Chapter 35. "First, as your librarian, I congratulate you all on your success, not only for your kind, but in the project you were given. Your species possesses qualities, perspectives, and particular utilities that place you high among the ranks of beings useful to the Carrix, and you as individuals have gained specific attention. As your people are redistributed and reassigned within the moieties, your positions will be noted and your usefulness recorded. In the time between now and the commencement of your new duties, you will remain in these quarters. When your duties change, you will be found here
and the details of your new responsibilities will be presented to you. The duties you are given will be assigned by me and guided by those who direct me. My duty will be to lower myself by interacting with animals for the greater advantage of the Kariks. In this, I will give you advice and equipment as required for you to succeed and survive in your work. Your assignments will not be uniform. You will not have a voice in what your place within the moieties will be. The stability and advancement of the Kariks is your only path to a pleasant day-to-day life. If, as a subject species, your use to the Kariks changes, your place within the moieties will also change. With greater usefulness, your access to resources will increase. With less, it will decrease. As your keeper librarian, my position will vary with your own. In this way, we remain certain that your interests and mine are aligned. Some of you will be put in danger. The danger that you face will be balanced against the utility that your duties provide. Other subject species have proven unwilling or unable to address their duties, and their places have been altered to better fit their essential natures. This will also be true for you. Some of you will remain here. Others will travel to places within Kariks' control. Regardless of your location, you will answer to me as your librarian, and I will stand in aid of you to the degree that is appropriate. You will not approach or make requests of other members of the Kariks. Outside of your assigned duties, you are permitted other activity to the extent that it does not interfere with your work. You are permitted to reproduce and breed. If your circumstances allow you to do so, you will be informed. It will be your responsibility to identify and maintain an optimal level of personal function. If you have requirements that you do not identify, this failing will affect your function and lead to a change in your position within the moieties. If you suffer developmental changes that affect your function, these changes will lead to a change in your position. If circumstances outside your function change the context and needs of the Kariks, these changes will lead to a change in your position. I understand that it is comforting to you to believe your efforts have meaning, and that comfort improves your function. In that spirit, know that through your efforts, we have determined that the world from which you were taken is better preserved than unmade. The cities your kind built stand for the time being. The lineages that produced you continue to exist. The artifacts of your culture are permitted and will be incorporated into the moieties as they are found useful. In this way, you have achieved the possibility that your species will spread to thousands of worlds you would otherwise never have known, and can flourish under the protection of the Kariks. Your people will be granted space to be fruitful and fecund as servants of the Kariks beyond anything they could have managed on their own. They will be given guidance and structure that will keep them safe from dangers that would have erased them from the universe had they stumbled into them. The moieties of the Kariks are, among other things, a great protection. You have won your species a place of calm and safety in a malefic universe. In this, you are your people's saviors. Continue. What is, is. In this, the new librarian said, you are your people's saviors. Continue. Its feeding arms plucked at each other, and its eyes moved from one to the other of them where they sat in the common room, among the cables and equipment and old, worn chairs and couches that had been new when they arrived. Outside, one thin layer of clouds passed among the ziggurats, and another softened the sky above them. Daffod waited. He didn't have the energy for more than that. What is, is, the translator box said.
It felt like a promise and a threat.
You will be taken from here when your places are ready, the librarian said, with a kind of finality.
Will we stay together? Jessen asked. The librarian paused, said,
That is unlikely.
Then turned to Daffod in particular.
The development of the human moiety is to change now. Your people were permitted to access the librarian before. That will end. You have presented yourself as the apt tool, and so you will be used according to your ability.
All right, Daffod said, and then a moment later, I don't know what that means.
Beginning now, all communication from your moiety will reach me through you as your connection to the Carracks moves through me. Their needs are your charge, and their discipline is your duty. They will speak to you, and you will speak to me. In this way, my exposure to animals will be minimized. Those whose duties take them to the lesser worlds will also report to you, though their duties will require them to have other animals to whom they answer. Any humans who approach me without you will be killed.
I'll be sure to pass that along, Daffod said, and was interrupted by his own small, choking laugh. In the deep sludge of his mind, objections and concerns began to bubble. It felt at the time like the first stirrings of wakefulness after a troubled and unrestful sleep.
I'll need to know who they are. I don't know where people are or what their work groups are.
I don't know anything.
That will be provided.
And what you expect of us?
The librarian paused, as if this were a new thought for it. Daffod didn't understand what the hesitation meant.
I will give directions to you, it said. You will arrange for them to be carried out.
If Daffod had had this position before, he could have stopped Ostencor's rebellion without losing anyone. He could have found an argument for something besides open rebellion or total obedience. Fewer of his friends would be dead. Else would be alive. It was too late for her, for Cynia. It wasn't too late for the rest of them. His mind began tripping forward, moving in subtle ways like the sound of water under snow. If he did this, he was going to need to be very careful how it got presented to people. Everyone was raw, traumatized, as emptied as he was. If he could be the one who made all this make a little bit of sense.
Can I ask, the old librarian, the one who was killed, why did that happen?
You, the Carrick said.
The rebellion? Ostencor's plan to kill the Carracks got too far, and that was the punishment?
There was no punishment. There is no punishment. That one was given great honor, being touched by the sovereign. But it was saved by an animal. There is no place in the moieties for a Carracks that was saved by an animal. Do you understand?
I'm starting to, he said.
Good, it said,
then lumbered out of the room on its massive red and black forearms, its abdomen gliding along behind like a servant struggling to keep up. The wide door closed, and they were alone in what had been their home for a time, their shared prison. As the librarian had delivered its speech, they'd fallen almost unconsciously into a rough circle, like children at story time. Daffod looked at them now as they sat in silence.
Kumpar, with his broad shoulders and wide hands, always ready with jokes and laughter, and hollowed out now. Tanner Fryce, who had been so arrogant and whose arrogance had been so justified, humiliated now, and still brilliant, still the one whose mind had completed the Carracks puzzle.
Jessen, with her newfound violence, and Jellet at her side, Ricker and his rage, and Daffod himself. What a strange, broken group they were. And then there were the ghosts, Else and her spy, Irina, Noel and Cynia, the gaps in the line.
The team scattered to the winds is a strange look for victory, Kumpar said.
Daffod sat forward, lacing his fingers together. The building around them ticked, and a thin wind muttered at the window. In the distance, something wide and dark rose from the top of a ziggurat, a Carrick's warship stretching its wings, preparing for another battle, another Asian, another wave in the permanent war that had eaten them. A moment later, another rose, and then another one after that. The endless violence of subjugation and conflict unfurled before Daffod's eyes. The resistance, the purge that followed, the death after death after death. It was a strange moment to discover peace. But there peace was. And more than peace, a clarity that seemed to reach deep into his mind and reorder him. The feeling that flowed through him was what he imagined the release was in the last breath of life, the moment where the end was obviously inevitable. How odd that it should come at the beginning of something, too.
"There's a war, you know," he said.
"There is," Jellet agreed. "And if there's a war, there's an enemy. Something out there that wants the Carricks dead."
"Excellent taste on their part," Kumpar said. "If they have a charity, I'll give them a percentage of my salary."
"I'm starting to understand the Carricks," Daffod said. "To understand how they think. Not all of it, but some. Enough." Ricker snorted.
"Not sure that's something to brag about. They seem like a bunch of bloodthirsty monsters to me."
"They aren't, though. There's something else. They have different assumptions and axioms, different ways of understanding things like free will and what it means to be a person, different blind spots. But some of it I get. I'm like they are in some ways. Or I can be."
"Again," Ricker said, "not something to brag on."
Jellet leaned forward and touched his arm gently. Tanner chuckled, and then Jessen. Daffod felt the anger and the pain in the laughter, and also the warmth. They'd become like siblings who knew each other too well for terms like love and hate to apply anymore. They had become complicated. He felt Else's presence as if she were still in the room, and not only a memory.
"So," Kumpar said, "now we wait and see what they require us to do next."
"No, I don't know," Daffod said. "If we're part of this grand mechanism of theirs, then maybe we can be the grit in its gears, too."
"You're starting to sound like Ustinkor," Jellet said.
"More patient. I'm more patient. Ustinkor wasn't wrong. He was just too fast about it all. He wanted a final battle when it was still something he'd lose," Daffod said, thinking it through as he spoke, finding words for the shape of his revelation.
"So we all get sent off to who knows where while you fight your patient war," Ricker said. "Now you're the high priest of the human race?"
Everyone was staring at him. Ricker was right. The Carricks had made him their high priest, the only voice between them and a vicious, capricious god. So he needed a prophecy then.
"I don't know what's going to happen to us all," Daffod said. "But I just want to say, while we're still in the same place, while we're here together, that I'm going to find a way to kill them."
The faces in the circle were sober, filled with doubt, but yearning to believe. I'm going to learn everything about them. I'm going to figure out how to get in their heads. And I'm going to kill them all and burn their fucking towers to the ground. It's my war now. Chapter 36. The swarm is in chaos. Part of this is the nature of its new flesh. For the first time, it feels the cognitive deformation of a high testosterone environment, and even with shutting off the hormone as soon as it had taken control, the brain and body have been formed in ways that are subtly different. The new host fights more violently against his death. The rage and despair taste different. There are moments when the swarm feels like it could almost lose control. Not in the way its hosts have lost control, of course. It cannot die or be displaced. It is as if Jellit has been reduced to a series of habits and tics that the swarm will revert to if it isn't careful. It looks out the window at the wide, blocky structures of the Carracks using new eyes. For all the changes and alterations that it worked on Else Yanin's flesh, there had been some underlying commonality. Jellit sees things differently. The swarm shifts through the spectrum, remaking its sensorium. It finds the lines of force that arc through the high air, the flickers of heat on the distant ground, the shimmer at the edge of ultraviolet frequencies. Jellit's body experiences all of them a bit differently, like two different dancers performing the same choreography. "Are you all right?" Jessen asks. The remnants of the man scream and push and flail, but these are only metaphors, because he has no body to scream or push or flail with. The others, the two dead women, watch and sympathize. "Just thinking," the swarm says. If we go, maybe they'll send us to the same place." The swarm smiles and takes her hand. Jellit's conflict shifts through it. The heartbreaking love of the brother for his sister, the resentment of yet another scenario where he is called upon to support her, the rage and horror at experiencing her fingers lacing around the swarm's. "Maybe," it says. "Maybe." And its heart aches. The right thing to do is leave. The right thing to want is to leave. If it can find its way to a colony world, a captured planet with less vicious security than the World Palace, it will transmit all it's learned. It will whisper the secrets that might give its side an edge into vast radio ears that are waiting for it. That is the reason for its presence. That is what all the people it has been died for. What all the dead that they loved took to the Carracks' altar with them. It doesn't want to go. The swarm is in love. "That's bullshit," the remnant of Amir says. "Else loves him. You're just in the habit of feeling what she felt." "I loved him, but I was already dead," Else says. "I was never with Daffod before I died. I was dead before we even kissed." She means, "It's not my fault." As though originating intention could be separated out in the soup that was becoming their shared minds. The swarm tries not to pay attention to the distracting chaos of their echoes. The mind that once was Jellit screams. It chooses not to attend to that either. "There is another way," it formulates. "It can create a data packet, carve a part of itself away, insert the military intelligence into the body of one of the others. They can carry it to the far stars without knowing that it is there, and when it is safe, the packet will bloom. It won't be pleasant for the carrier, but it will let the swarm remain." "Won't be pleasant," Amir says. It'll kill them. But what's one more corpse? It lets Jessen's hand go without meaning to. Or perhaps Jellit, the echo of Jellit, releases her in hopes that she will move away. Instead, she leans her head against the swarm's shoulder. It smells her hair, experiences Jellit's flashbulb memory of holding her when she was in the hospital, when she was sick. It puts its arm around her and hopes that she will not have to die. Its mind turns to Daffod. The thrill in its new blood is different, but familiar. The guilt and shame are bound up with the remembered warmth of his body, the taste of his mouth. The comfort that it has taken in him, that it still longs for. Daffod is in his own room now, and when it reaches out its senses, it can hear the peculiar harmony of his breath, the rhythm of his heart, just a little different from all the others, like the timbre of his voice. It remembers him, full of focus and purpose and a steely cold, swearing himself against the Carracks, and it lets itself dream. The minds of the two women it has lived as have taught it to do that, to imagine fictions and place itself in them as an escape, as a comfort. It imagines the two of them, spies in the World Palace, working together. The burden of its mission shared at last with someone who could know it completely. It imagines finding some secret path to the heart of the Carracks, of detonating a bomb at the root of the world, of holding hands while they watch the towers fall, of making love on the corpse of a civilization. And why not? Even if they fail, why shouldn't they try? What will it be like to kiss him with these lips? He's not going to want you, Amir says. He was in love with me, El says. He thinks it was me. And you killed me. Twice over, you killed me. He'll hate you for that. He's going to hate you. Far out, beyond the atmosphere, something bloomed in a geometry of radiation and magnetic force. Circles define hexagons. Hexagons define intersecting planes, all of it opening and then falling away. Like the ideal of an orchid playing out on five-dimensional space. The swarm records the phenomenon, tucks the data in with all the rest. It doesn't know what made the effect, but it isn't called to. It is only meant to look, listen, record, and transmit. It is made to deceive and go unnoticed. The longing that pulls at it, the despair and the hope, it was not designed for them. It feels them all the same. Daffod, my love, it is not just your war. You and I, we will burn this world down together. The End. This book was read for you by Jefferson Mays, a member of SAG-AFTRA. We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Mercy of Gods, Book 1 of The Captive's War, by James S. A. Corey. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold. Thank you for listening to Recorded Books.